Well, today's a pretty exciting day. It's a big week for Blue Valley Baptist with Vacation Bible School coming, and our kids are both excited. Tieran gets to help this year, and so she's excited about that. Ethan's pumped up about being a part of VBS. He always enjoys that. And we've got a really special treat as well. Tiff's dad and his wife are with us today. We have not got to see them. Has it been a year? Maybe a year and a half?
A year and a half.
They are from Brazil. And so if you have any questions about the Olympics that are coming up, make sure you grab them. I'm sure they have plenty of answers. Just kidding. But we're thrilled. They came in late last night. We only got to see them this morning. And so my first chance to get to say hello was in this room, and so we're excited about getting a couple of days with them and spending time with them. It's one of the greatest things about summer. To say these were tough times for the disciples and for followers of Jesus would be a major understatement. When we read the passage, we often solely focus on the characters of Peter and Judas, the concepts of betrayal and denial. We experience both emotions of disgust and disbelief as we think of all that happened, wondering how either one could have done that. But in all honesty, all of us in this room can relate to both the concepts of denial and betrayal in our relationships with people, whether we inflicted those or they were inflicted upon us, and in our relationship with Jesus. This passage accurately displays that under the right circumstances in the lives of the followers of Jesus, our depth of relationship or lack thereof can and will be seen when we are placed in pressure time periods in our lives. However, if we ask questions during those tough times, we can learn to grow and even deepen. And that's our hope for today as we look at this passage. Three snapshots are given in the passage we read. One, Jesus' arrest in the garden. Two, Jesus before Annas. And three, Peter outside by the fire. Each scene reveals volumes about the character of the principles involved. And as we watch the three of them engage the events they were involved in, we find the basis for the tough questions we should ask ourselves as we think about our responses to the tough times we encounter. So notice in your bulletins there are some notes. The first question, if you're a blank filler inner, is we need to ask, am I promoting? According to September 2012, an article found in Forbes magazine on self-promotion, putting yourself out there is not an amorphous concept. Amorphous basically means without defined shape or form. To put yourself out there effectively means you practice self-promotion. You showcase your value and you engage the audience who are making the decisions or know about the opportunities. You raise your odds of serendipitous outcomes, unexpected offers, and lucky breaks if you do that. We live in a world of self-promotion. It's challenging to stay away from that, especially when we have opportunities to propel ourselves in positions. That is often what is looked for. Years ago, Jay Locke and I went to a conference here in town. There was a well-known Christian author that was there amongst other speakers, and we were excited about hearing him. It had been years since we'd had that opportunity. So as he began, it was a question-answer time. One of the questions that was asked him, who is one of your greatest influencers? We began to share about this gentleman who, when he was in middle school, began to invest his life in him, a student pastor, and later years went on to have a really global impact in different areas of our world. And how a lot of people knew this guy, knew his involvement, his influence. He made a major impact. So the reason he had shared that, because days before that, this gentleman had passed away. Planned the services for the funeral, and because there were so many that responded that were coming, they couldn't find a venue that would hold them, so they had to rent out a baseball stadium for this guy who died. Of course, this gentleman that was on stage was one of the speakers. So he talked about how this guy invested his life in his deep discipleship and how there was no way in the world this gentleman had time to spend with a middle schooler. He was grateful that he did. Pretty profound story. Well, as the interview progressed, there were a couple of other questions that were asked, long dialogue. And then after that, there was a question about, well, what is your schedule and what is your regimen like now? This gentleman had just recently become married about a year before that, had a dog, which for those dog owners know that takes quite a bit of time to take care of your pets. And he began to talk about how his schedule's pretty regimented and how he has people that work for him in an organization. And for some reason, he got on this tangent and talked about this guy who had come up to him at a previous conference that he was at and asked him, hey, I'd like to grab coffee with you. Do you have time for that? Then he began to go on this discourse about why this gentleman on stage, well-known author, didn't have 45 minutes to go spend time with this guy for coffee because he was too busy. He had too many other priorities. He needed to get prepared for all of his speaking engagements that he had. He needed to spend time with his wife on the phone. He needed to check in on his dog, and he had all these other things. And how if he did that, because of the time expense, 45 minutes, he would have to fire someone from his organization because he couldn't spare 45 minutes. I don't know that he realized he was going to be asked those questions when he was on stage, but the three of us sat there and looked at that and thought, okay, you just shared how this gentleman that invested his life in you in middle school and high school and didn't have time to do it made a profound impact. And now you're saying because you have notoriety and because you're well known that you don't have 45 minutes to spend with someone for a coffee, regardless of what the gentleman's reasons were for wanting to spend time with him. I don't even know if you realized he was saying it when he was up there, but we caught it. And we thought, okay, what is he promoting by what he's doing? He's not promoting an accurate picture of who Jesus was. We see all through the Gospels, Jesus always responded to people, even when he was exhausted. He had a deep love and care for and concern for those around him. He never denied someone to come up and spend time with them, especially children. So when this guy sat there and shared that, we just looked at each other like, does he even realize what he's talking about? What is he doing? Really caught us off guard. His impression of this individual may have been skewed, and in essence, he may have been right. Maybe he wasn't going to get anything from that conversation. But how could you consider your time more valuable, even to the point of firing someone that important? That you are that important, that you are a picture of someone who is that great. Well, Judas may have been a guy somewhat like that. If you remember, just before this scene in the garden, the disciples and Jesus had spent time up in the upper room, and each one had gone to him, and Jesus is at me, because he said, one of you would betray me. Obviously, the guys in the room didn't know it was Judas, or they would have all stood up, pointed their finger, and say, let's get him out of here. They obviously, because they had walked with him for 3.5 years and spent time together in that way, thought he was one of them. They didn't expect that it was him. So Judas made the decision. I'm going to betray Jesus. I'll take those 30 silver coins, and it'll happen in the garden one night. I'll take a band of 600 soldiers with me, and we'll take care of this. This was the moment. We have to be asking the question. The same way when J. West Jaylock and I were standing there, what were you thinking? And even sharing a story like that, Judas, what were you thinking in that moment? Several potential reasons have been given over time to try to answer that question. The simplest and I believe most accurate is that Judas was captured by greed. He saw an opportunity to, quote unquote, better himself, be in a better position, gain monetary reward, possibly get a position with the Jewish leadership, maybe even be seen as a hero for those who despised Jesus by being the one who stepped up and turned him over. All of those things may have been driving him. After all, in this moment, he was in charge. And who of us in this room does honestly not like to, at times, be in charge? That too may have been driving him. If we're honest, we can totally relate. Even the most devoted of Jesus followers can get sidetracked when opportunities to present ourselves and to advance our positions come about. At times, God allows us to get what we want, but only every time to find out that what we thought would be fulfilling was not. Because true fulfillment is only in our lives when we are closely, intimately walking with Jesus. That's where it's found. Regardless of how we see it, on this night, in the chaos of the garden, a man who had, as Christian author Max Lucado describes him, seen Jesus but not known him, heard him but not understood him, had eyes focused on his agenda in the chaos of that night, and he worked feverishly to promote it. I don't believe Jesus realized in the events of those moments what the end game would be for him. When he went to the Pharisees and Sadducees initially, said that I will turn on Jesus for 30 silver coins. They went to the upper room. They went to the garden. He came with the 600 soldiers. Jesus was taken, crucified, beaten, buried, resurrected. And where does Jesus end up? In a field, taking his own life. When these circumstances began for him, I don't believe he thought, I can't wait to end up in a field hanging myself. We too can relate to that. A lot of times we see things that are out there for us, and we believe that those will be what we want, what our lives will be able to have, and in all honesty, to experience true fulfillment. That job promotion, that move for us, that position that we've always wanted, that relationship we've always wanted to have. We think that that will bring us a great deal of comfort, encouragement, fulfillment. But oftentimes we don't consider the cost in advance. We don't think that to take that promotion, I'm going to be estranged from my spouse. I'm actually going to be gone so much that I'm not even going to know my kids. We often don't think that putting our kids in different places will cause a distance between us as well. We make decisions not counting the cost, and years later we look back wondering, what was it all for? Why did I make those decisions that I made? Look at the results. If I would have just known this was going to be the end, I would have changed fill in the blank. And all of us have stories like that because none of us is perfect. None of us have walked a perfect life. Sacrifices do come. But what are we sacrificing for and why? We also need to consider whose name will be raised if we promote ourselves and our agendas. Is it Jesus' name or ours? It's one of the most amazing things about this picture in this particular part of the gospel. Jesus was so focused on his Father that he wasn't promoting his own agenda. It was about the Father's will. We too fall into traps, as Judas, of promoting ourselves because we do like the notoriety. We do like our names to be raised in lights. We like receiving the awards. But if you'll notice, as I do, those trophies or awards or the other things that we often receive become dusty, dingy, the shine's gone. And instead of receiving the gratitude or the accolades that we thought would again bring fulfillment, when they don't, when we look at those things on the shelf, we once again ask the question, what was that for? And the appreciation we thought we should have been shown never seems to measure up. We find ourselves looking for more down the road. When difficult times come to our lives, that which is most important to us is pushed to the surface, and our instincts are protect, advance, and promote. But we have a strong challenge if we take a look at how seriously Jesus responded to this. He didn't ask the question, why is this happening to me? That's a common default for us as well. We walk through things in life and we ask, why is this happening? What's going on? But it's hard not to go there when things become difficult, especially if we believe we've heard from God on something. That can be a trap. We think there's going to be, once again, a certain outcome that doesn't come about, and we wonder, how did I miss it? It is hard to do and impossible unless we're walking with the Spirit to be able to recognize the things that come our way and the way that God desires that we draw closer to Him. The reality of life is that we do and will experience hardships. And the degree of difficulties faced in life often increases as we get older. And we get frustrated at times when we don't get our way. But how do we handle it when it does? The truth, whether we like it or not, is that the holiest of people may be placed in the most painful positions in life. How do we know that? Because of Jesus and his example. At times, we will experience those things. Jesus stayed on course. His eyes were on his Father and his mission, the sinless one taking on the sin of the world to offer forgiveness to those who surrender their lives to Jesus, was fulfilled. Henry Blackaby calls moments like that in our lives crisis of belief in the workbook Experiencing God, the times in which we determine whether we're going to follow God's voice and direction or our own. And respond to tough times by choosing our own way. We are not unlike Judas. We refuse to embrace the opportunity those tough times present because we are concerned about promoting our agenda and our lives over God's. We have to ask a question. That's a tough one. The second one, am I helping? As I've already shared, most of us, if not all, love being in the driver's seat. And at times we like being the one who rescues someone else or the hero in those situations. Remember in Star Wars Episode 4, how could you forget if you've seen that 1977, Obi-Wan driving with Luke and R2-D2, the land speeder coming up into town. They're the stormtroopers. So what happens in that moment? Stormtrooper asks, let me see some identification. The famous Obi-Wan, you don't need to see our identification. Stormtrooper, we don't need to see their identification. And then he says, these aren't the droids you're looking for. These aren't the droids we're looking for. You don't need any more information from us. Move along. And they get away. Obi-Wan clearly in that is the hero. What a great power to be able to just do this and change somebody's mind. Wouldn't it be great, dads, if we could do that with our daughters? Comes home, dad, I really like this guy named Jimmy. You don't like Jimmy. Dad, I don't like Jimmy. You don't even want to be his friend today. I don't even need to be his friend. Go to your room and spend time reading a great novel. I'm going to go to my room and read a novel. Move along. I'm moving along. See you, Dad. Wouldn't it be awesome to be able to have that strength, that gift, that ability to say, hey, do this, do that. You know as well as I do, our kids grow and our amount of influence in their lives changes over time. What was once a baby, wailing, crying, needing everything from us, diapers changed, rocking to sleep, feeding, becomes a 21-year-old one day. And they no longer would enjoy walking into the house every time they saw us. And okay, come sit on my lap, let's rock, I'm going to put you down for a nap. Most 21-year-olds would not respond well to that. We as well as parents would never expect that. We want them to grow and learn and to walk through life, hopefully loving and knowing Jesus. It's not about deception. We don't want to be able to wave our hand and try to deceive our kids into doing something that they normally, naturally would not do. We hope they take our influence and they hear us. But we know things change over time. Jesus, in this situation, if you remember, when the crowds came, when the mob showed up, didn't say, you don't need to be here. No, he said, I am the one you're looking for. What was the response? They all fell to their face. Jesus didn't. They fell to their face. Then he asked them the question again, who is it you're looking for? Jesus of Nazareth. And he said, what? I am he. When he did that, he also said, let these men go. He was prepared and ready. So now we see Peter in one of the most famous moments in all of the New Testament, whipping out the sword and cutting off Malchus's ear. It's almost like he was ready for the cage match of death. Ric Flair and Peter versus the Road Warriors. Who knows what was coming, but he would be a guy in that situation I would think you would want to be with you. Right? Any situation that came up, you want someone to jump to your defense. You want someone to run in there, be aggressive, and help you. But this was not one of those moments when Jesus was looking for help. In fact, he rebuked Peter and said, this is my cup. And he put the ear back on Malchus and was healed, and than they took Jesus. When faced with trying times, we often think, as Peter did, we need to help. We see broken relationships, we see issues with people, and we think, hey, I've got to act, I've got to step in. And I'm not talking about obedience. There are two different things there. Obedience is one where we feel led by God to do something specifically and we respond. We are called to do that. As followers of Jesus, we are called to be obedient. But if we're doing it as a result of, I've got to step in and act because Jesus needs my help, then we need to take a step back and ask, does he? Like Peter, we at times draw our sword and we feel good about actually doing something, but soon there's blood on the ground and we've made things worse, and a rebuke from Jesus is coming. When faced with a tough time, we have to ask, am I helping or am I responding to Jesus in obedience? And sometimes those lines can be skewed. That's a tough one. Next one, am I trembling? We are meant to see a stark contrast between Peter in the garden and trembling over a warming fire, not from the cold, but from fear. The moment in the garden has now been overmatched by the reality of the situation, and the one who was fearless was not overwhelmed with fear in that moment, but soon became that in minutes, in hours. He was in a situation beyond his control, beyond his help. His journey with Jesus wasn't turning out as he had planned. He was scared to death, even to admit that he knew Jesus. Many of us have heard stories of those who have been murdered for following Jesus, some brutally. And many of us believe if we were placed in a similar situation, we too would die for him. But I believe the greater question for us to answer at this point is, would we live for him? For those that know us in the community, outside of this room, outside of our families, do they know the true person that you are and who you claim to hold so closely to? Do they know you are a follower of Jesus? Do they see it in your life? Do they see characteristics that relate to you knowing him? When push comes to shove, do you deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me? Do I deny myself, take up my cross, and follow Jesus? Or do I crouch in fear? A very important practical application is seen for us here. I think this is often missed as well. At times, when we go through great spiritual triumph, what soon comes on the back end is great spiritual difficulty. Peter, when he took out his sword, probably thought this is going to be the greatest moment of victory of all time because I'm defending Jesus. The opposite result came, crouching in fear. We too need to be prepared at times where we speak the most loudly for Jesus, where we hold up the banner the highest. Who is waiting there like a prowling lion looking for those he devours? It's our enemy, Satan. He wants to discourage and defeat us and tell us that because of what's taken place in our lives, there is no good that we could ever do. There is no way that we can strictly follow Jesus. We know that is a lie, but at times we buy into it. We need to remember who we are. Our answers to these first three questions say volumes about that, how deep our faith really is, and what would cause us not only to deny, but to betray the one we say we love the most and who loves us the most. Knowing these things about ourselves, we have to ask, what can we do about our tendencies to promote ourselves, to help Jesus, and to be fearful? Well, that's when we look at Jesus, the main person in John 18. And we ask the question, am I resting? Your fourth one. Don't get me wrong. I don't mean to communicate in any way that this was easy for Jesus. In other biblical books about Jesus' life, we know that he said to his disciples in the garden that his soul was overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. We know that he cried out in prayer to God, asking if there was any other way. So this wasn't easy for Jesus. And yet, when the angry mob charged, all the biblical books about Jesus' life show us a life in a Jesus who was calm. He was resting in his Father's will for his life, That response is our target. But seeing what Jesus did doesn't do us any good unless we pay attention to how he did it. We'll never imitate the rest Jesus demonstrates that night if we don't imitate the pattern he followed to achieve the rest. So three things stand out. Here they are. Number one, first, Jesus had prepared himself for this moment by staying intimately connected to the Father. His relationship was constant. It was never broken. And he was not cut off from the world. Remember, everywhere Jesus went, people wanted to see him. Some wanted to touch the hem of his garment. Many needed help. Many needed healing. And he never turned people away. He was always with them. He always responded to their need. But he always kept his eyes firmly focused on the Father. In this crisis, he was the same person he always had been before. So the challenge for us is this. We need to be the same people that we are at church, that we are at home, that we are at school, that we are at work, that we are in the community. We need to be the same person everywhere as a follower of Jesus, not segment or fragment our lives. If we do that, when things come that are challenges, we'll respond, and hopefully in a way that lifts up the name of the one that we claim. Next, the reason so many of us promote or help or tremble is that we lack the preparation Jesus showed. We have got to stay connected to him in his word, in prayer, in worship, with other believers. And we need to consistently share our faith with the lost. Those are practical applications for us. If you have not yet begun those in your journey with Jesus, start. You've got to start somewhere. If you're doing that and you're walking and you're spending time, keep it up and keep growing and watch how God changes you to make you more like himself. We all need to grow. None of us is there yet. He could rest in tough times because he was prepared. We need to be prepared. Finally, because Jesus was prepared, he could trust. Again, I call us back to Jesus' rebuke of Peter in verse 11. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? That statement shows us something of major importance. It shows us that Jesus trusted the Father regardless of what he faced. And that gave him confidence. We too need to have that type of trust that regardless of what we face, if we are his followers, we know that he is with us. We are never alone. And we can't forget that. There are things in life, circumstances, people, places, and our enemy who constantly war against that. We can't let him have victory. We have got to remember that we are connected to him, that he is the one we are intimate with. If we do that, we'll experience power and rest. We all face moments when the circumstances of our lives will reveal the true character of our lives. And if we have learned anything from these scenes in John 18 this morning, we have learned that we prepare ourselves for these moments. We have to recognize, even if we feel prepared, there are times that we won't be and we'll blow it. It's part of being people. So in those moments, we go back to the Lord, repent. We do as 1 John 1:9 says, if we confess our sin, he is faithful and just and will forgive us and purify us from all unrighteousness. We confess it. We allow his forgiveness to take hold in our lives. And we forgive ourselves. Because once again, none of us has achieved perfection yet. One day, when we see him face to face, yes, but not here. We need to stay closely connected to the Father, remembering we cannot make it through this life without his power. We deny or betray Jesus. We do that. We take action. We make it right. And we move on with life. And as broken people, we see how God uses our brokenness, as has been sung over and over again, to bring about his beauty to those around us. And we take great hope and confidence in that.